You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 169. It's not about sympathy or likability either. Empathy is about the translation of feeling. Anonymous.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Well, guys, today on the show, we have screenwriter Rich Wilkes. And Rich is known for writing Triple X, Airheads, and a plethora of other projects that he's had over the course of his career. And this conversation really took an amazing turn where Rich and I really discussed what it's like to be a Hollywood screenwriter, the realities and the ugly truths of being a Hollywood screenwriter from the inside out, what happens to a screenwriter who has a tremendous amount of success like he did in Triple X, the mistakes he made, and so on. So it is really a prerequisite for anybody who wants to be a screenwriter to listen to this episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my eye-opening conversation with Rich Wilkes. I'd like to welcome to the show Rich Wilkes. How you doing, Rich?
Hey, man. I'm doing great, Alex. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I think it's going to be a fun episode. I have a good feeling about this because based on your credits alone, I think you and I could have a beer, even though I don't drink, but I could definitely have a beer.
All right. Well, that sounds good. I hope so. I want to learn something from you.
So first of all, why did you get into this insane business and how did you get into this insane business?
UC Santa Cruz, and they didn't have a film program, but I wanted to do film. So I did theater arts with a film emphasis, and they didn't have screenwriting major. So I wrote my own major, which was a screenplay, and submitted that rather than doing a film or a play or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I went to American Film Institute for screenwriting. It's a 2-year MFA. After the first year, one of my scripts got optioned by Touchstone. And so they were going to pay me $10,000 for this option, and AFI at the time cost $10,000. And I figured, well, why don't I just pocket the $10,000 and quit? So I quit, halfway through AFI. I never got my master's, but I figured the whole point of going there was to get
to be employable.
Yeah. And so since I got the thing sold or optioned anyway, I bailed as quick as I could.
Did that get produced?
It actually did. Yeah. It wound up being the one, you had Chris Moore a few weeks ago on the podcast. It was the first movie that he produced. He was my agent.
Oh, so it was Glory Days.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. So we'll get into Glory Days in a minute. Was there a film that kind of lit your fire, man? Is there that one movie that you saw, you were just like, oh, I want to go into this business. I want to join the circus. That's what it is. We're all carnies and we've joined the circus.
Yeah, I never really thought about going into the movie business until college, when I met people that, a guy whose dad worked on MASH. And I was like, really, you can do that? You can actually work on MASH? You know, and that made it real for me that, you know, maybe I could move to LA and work on something. But prior to that, I never had any clue that it was possible. I thought it was, you know, it was very insular and you had to grow up here and know somebody. My favorite movie growing up was Gallipoli, the Peter Weir movie.
Yeah. With Mel Gibson. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not of the, I want to make Jaws and Star Wars and Raiders kind of crowd. Those movies I love, but they aren't the ones that maybe say, hey man, I want to do this for a living. I thought that Gallipoli was such a great combination of history and a personal story, that it blew my mind. So after finding out that it's possible and then studying it and going to AFI and getting it set up, I've actually managed to, since, oh, I want to say 1991, 30 years now, do this for a living without having to have another job, which is like, you know, ridiculous.
And isn't that the goal of this whole thing? It's like, we can make a living writing or directing or just being part of the circus. I mean, that's the goal.
That's the entire thing. Yeah. My initial thought was, I want to get into movie business because I don't want to work that hard. And this will give me a lot of free time. And you realize that doesn't really work.
That didn't work out that way. And that's another thing. A lot of people think that's like, oh, screenwriting. You wake up, you write for a couple hours, and then you goof off all day and the rest of the day, and that's it. And then they throw obscene amounts of money at you, because everyone is Shane Black and Joe Esterhaus back in the 90s. Oh. So that's the way. Well, I mean, it's funny because, you know, like I was saying earlier before we got on, like, you and I are similar vintage. So, you know, we were coming up in the 90s. It was a magical time. It was a crazy magical time. Screenwriters were getting the option booms or the spec boom of Shane Black, Joe Esterhaus, and, you know, $2-3 million, $4 million for a movie. That lit a lot of fires of like, oh, I'm going to be a screenwriter. I can get rich being a screenwriter.
Yeah. For me, it wasn't the boom time for that. It was the boom time of being able to pitch a movie and then get paid to write it. And by pitch it, I mean a 5-minute pitch.
Like The Player. Yeah. Like The Player.
Exactly. Right. And then now, you know, you have to have the script written with the star, the director, the financing before anybody consider it. But back then you'd go in and say, I got this idea. It's going to be Dog Day Afternoon in a radio station. It's going to be, you know, a lot of rock and roll music, blah, 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 blah. Great. Fine. Go write it. And I would, between me and my friends, you know, I would have five pitches set up around town, and you'd knock out this script and then go on to the next one. And it was so fucking easy because they had this incredible budget to develop their own material. All the studios wanted to do that. So they would commission 125 scripts in order to make 20.
Right.
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 So that was a lot of writers making a living off of, you know, these scripts for hire, which just unfortunately has completely gone away. And now I think if you're lucky, they'll put out 6 movies a year, a particular studio. And of those, maybe they make half and the rest are coming from financing from somewhere else. And they're just distributing the damn thing. So they aren't paying writers to come in and pitch and write these scripts for them. There's no need for them to do that anymore, apparently.
And the funny thing is, which is bizarre, is that now there's more need for content ever. There is a content boom, and there's never been more money sloshing around in town than ever before. What is it? 17 million $17 billion for Netflix this year, $33 billion for Disney Plus. I mean, and you know, HBO and everyone. So everyone's looking for content, but you would think that pitching would be the easiest way to get things done and to be more of that, but you're absolutely right. It has gone the complete opposite way. You need the script, the star, the budget, the financing. You need to literally, you know, plug and play project for them to look, not even guaranteed, for them to even have a conversation with you nowadays. It's insane.
Yeah, this changed. It was a marked change right when the Writers Guild was going on strike in 08.
Yep, 08.
So there was the housing bubble, and then the writer's strike was coming, and I had a pitch with Amblin. Mm-hmm. And it was right before the strike. And I, you know, they called me up the day of and they said, listen, we're changing our policy. Unless you're coming through the door with Will Smith attached to your pitch, don't bother coming. And I'm like, if I could get Will Smith attached to my thing, what the fuck do I need you for?
Right. Right.
This is your function. I'm supposed to be the idea guy. You guys are supposed to be the make the fucking movie guys. And it's completely swapped now where producers who used to have deals on lots and a development budget and have their own, you know, slate are begging writers to write on spec in the hopes that we can lure a director to hop on board, to lure a fucking actor who means something, to lure a Netflix into paying for it. And that's where I am on several different projects. It's a fucking joke, you know.
Yeah, no, it's insane. And I know a lot of writers who, you know, they have, cause a lot of times, you know, people will look at an IMDb and they'll go, oh, you know, he only made that one movie. I'm like, yeah, he might've made that one movie, got produced, but he's been working in town for 15 years on projects that never, and he's made a really good living as a writer. But those days are slowly just going away. The spec market, there is still a spec market, but it's literally a minuscule amount. It's very, very small. And there's basically just the one dude that does, one agent, Boxer Bomb, who does all the specs.
I mean, did the writers of these specs get Shane Black in 1994 money or no?
No, they're getting seven figures. They're getting they're getting a mil maybe, you know? And again, we're throwing numbers around like you and I are like, you know, pooping out, you know, $100 bills, but it's not the way it is. But generally they are getting those, but we're talking about one or two where they were like, there were one or two a week. Now they're maybe a handful a year. And they're not getting Shane Black money. Do you know the story of, what's the last Action Hero, the Shane Black Last Action Hero story?
Last Boy Scout or
Action? No, Last Action Hero.
Okay.
The story. I heard this from a good buddy of mine inside the business who told me this is how crazy the spec market got. And this was the top of the bubble. This is when it popped. After this, it popped. The agent for Shane Black called up. He called up Shane. Hey Shane, what do you got going on? He goes, I've got this idea. And they went out to dinner. They told us that he goes, write the idea down on the napkin. And it was the idea for Last Action Hero. For everyone listening, Google Last Action Hero, Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, I like it, but you know, it had a rough time. Anyway, he took the napkin, went back to his office, called every studio head in town and said, I have Shane Black's next log line. No script. I have his next log line on a napkin. If you want to bid on it, you have to come to my office and read it. Don't send anybody. You've got to come. So all six or eight studio heads showed up to this office, read the napkin. 2 days later, there's a bidding war. He got $4 million.
Okay. I may be wrong, but I think you have the wrong title because Zach Penn and Adam Leff wrote Last Action Hero.
Are you sure it's last? No.
You must be thinking of Last Boy Scout, no?
Was it Last Boy Scout? All right. Well, I think it was Last Action Hero but Shane Black wrote Last Action Hero. All right, hold on. Everybody stop for a second. We're gonna now it's because I have to check this. I'm almost positive he did because it made the most sense that he did. So let's go to handy IMDb live on the show. And let's see if Rich is right or if I'm right, because I've been telling that story for a while now. No one has ever called me on it, and I'm almost bet money. I'm like,
You know who would have called you on it is Chris Moore, who was Adam and
yes!
agent at the time.
Right. So Last Action Hero. 1 second. My modem is still loading up.
Good Lord. Now let me do it.
My modem is still loading up. I have the free AOL disk.
Yeah. Are you plugged into the Pete's Coffee down the block?
No. Let me get this. That's too funny. So writers are Zach Penn, but hold on for a second. And you know what? Shane Black. No, it was Shane Black.
He rewrote. Our guys, Zach and Adam, wrote the original spec. Shane rewrote.
So then it must have been Last Boy Scout. Then you were out. My mistake. So I was correct. Thank you, sir, for me saving face now for all the stories I ever tell again. But anyway.
Yes. Okay.
But that's how crazy the spec market was at the time. And a lot of screenwriters out there still think it's the 90s.
Yeah.
And they're acting as such, where I think just you saying what we just discussed about you need a package now, you need Will Smith attached, that's news to a lot of screenwriters. A lot of screenwriters think that you could write the amazing script and that you're going to get it produced just because of its genius. Yeah. And I know you and I both have read scripts that are Oscar quality that have never been produced, are sitting on shelves right now. Is that fair?
And then there's ones that you wonder how it got all of these movie stars attached and got made for a record amount of money.
Right.
When if it was a spec script, no one would look at it twice.
Right.
I don't know. It's not up to me to decide what's good and bad. But from my perspective, there's a lot of things that are happening because it's from the production company of the star and he's hooked up with a director and they've done three things together and they know blah, 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 blah. And so it's like, okay, we know they're responsible for the money. We know X amount of people are going to watch so-and-so do a fucking action comedy or whatever the hell it is. So we're going to go with that, which is great if you can be in that business. If you could be in the Adam Sandler
You read my mind.
It's fantastic. But there's not too much room in that bubble, I know.
No, and which brings me to one of your first films, Airheads, which had a young Adam Sandler, Brendan Fraser, and Steve Buscemi in it. I loved that movie when it came out.
Awesome, thank you.
I watched that movie when it came out. I was like, it was so much fun. And Adam had already come out with Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, or not yet.
No, this was – he'd only done a movie called – it was something about a clown. Maybe he was in the Bobcat Goldthwait clown movie, Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah,
clown.
Yeah. Yeah, Shakespeare. Clown, yeah.
Maybe he was in like a barroom scene or something. So he was in small stuff like that. But Airheads was his first studio movie. They wouldn't let him be the Brendan Fraser character. He had to be the supporting guy. And from that, I got hired to rewrite Billy Madison, which shot right afterwards.
Okay.
That's how I know that it came in that order.
Okay.
And that's how I know about the Adam Sandler bubble, because I'm not in it after doing two movies with him early on. Because I had not known him since I think the cutoff was SNL. You either knew him in high school, in college, or in SNL, and then you're part of the crew, and then afterwards I'm being facetious, but
sure.
That's what it feels like. Yeah. I mean, he's still working with Alan Covert, who he knows from, you know, college, and obviously all of the cast members from SNL that he worked with. He's just got this wonderful group, and why mess with something great unless you're going to go off and do some, you know, Uncut Gems thing, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
Hey, all right. So let's talk about those guys. What about guys like them and the guys that do the guy that did Blue Ruin? And the guys that did Synchronic, how are these guys getting money to make these movies? I mean, forget about Synchronic, because that's got, you know, that's already coming after the other one they did with actors that weren't big.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get a Blue Ruin made?
Thinking about like Uncut Gems specifically as an example, I think a film like that, you need a 800-pound gorilla, and Adam was that 800-pound gorilla. He'd already done Punch Drunk Love. So he's, you know, he's like, oh, and this is his other punch drunk love. And he's done a handful of those serious roles he likes to do every once in a while. I think he's actually a really good actor.
I agree, but forgetting about him, I'm talking about from the filmmaking side.
You're right,
the
yeah.
Brothers.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Right. But did they have Adam before?
No, before that they had Robert Pattinson.
Right.
And before that they had nobody.
Right. Right?
Same with the Blue Ruin guy. And the Synchronic guys are now doing what? They're doing Star Wars?
Right, probably. Yeah, so, because same thing with Gareth Edwards and those kind of guys. They jump from.
So they start out doing a movie with nobody in it. And then on the next one, they get an Anthony Mackie or a Pattinson or a Sandler. And then now they're doing King Kong fights in Tron or whatever.
I'd watch that.
So how do you get the money to do a Blue Ruin?
The thing, it's like anything else, man. From me speaking to so many people on the show over the years and just my own shrapnel in the business trying to get my own projects made over the years, it is almost impossible to figure out what it is for. There's no one formula. So there is generalized formulas like, you got Will Smith, you've got The Rock, you're in, it's done. You know, you got Gal Gadot, you got Sandy Bullock.
Yeah.
You're going to get a movie made. But it's luck, man. There's so much luck meets preparation meets opportunity. And I've talked to Oscar winners. I've talked to guys who just made a $5,000 movie. I've talked to everybody in between. It's always about right place, right time, right product. And, you know, if you happen to have a pandemic movie at the beginning of 2020 script rolling around,
yeah,
it's gone. If you had a terrorist movie in 2001,
yeah,
not gonna, you know, he had a Vietnam movie in 76, not so much. It took Oliver Stone forever to get Platoon made. And he had to do it. And look, that's a great example. Oliver, when he was on the show, I talked to him about Platoon. He's like, I had to go out to this independent, like absolute crazy man who did Salvador with him.
Right.
And from there, they're like, my friend, and I forgot who the producer was. I can't remember the name. But Oliver even did this actually. He goes, he was a shyster. He was an absolute crook. But he's like, we're going to go make this movie. Go to Philippines. Make this movie, The Platoon. Let's make it. but that's insane, though. So it was an insanity. You found this one guy who had the money at a time period where it made sense because VHS was starting to come, home video was coming on. He's like, I'd make the money. It's okay. And he went off and let him go do Platoon. And then that launched one of the greatest auteur filmmakers of his generation. And then from that point, he had a run of 10 years that no other filmmakers ever had. Like year after year after year after year, you know. But that's the thing. So there's a level of this kind of like, look at Mariachi. I mean, everyone always looks at Robert and Mariachi. How did that blow up? Right place.
It's same, but like, you know, Blair Witch Project is not going to.
It's an anomaly.
It's not going to punch through today.
No way.
But, you know, guys like Rian Johnson that are parlaying small independent movies into now doing the biggest movies in the business, the Russo brothers, whatever. Sure. All of these people, you know, the guy who did Jordan Voight Roberts, who did that wonderful Kings of Summer.
Yeah,
I love that movie. And then he's gone to these $150 million movies that I, you know, all of the stuff that I loved in Kings of Summer is gone from those because they're not personal and they're not whatever. But God bless him. He's making these goddamn huge movies that are blockbusters. I'm just fascinated by all of these guys who get to do it. But as you well know, going to Sundance or Slam Dance or what have you, when I went to Slam Dance, it must have been 96, 95. There was already 20,000 movies showing up, you know, being submitted, 20,000 feature films. I can't imagine how many it is now.
It's 70. I think Sundance had 70,000 pre-pandemic submissions.
Yeah. So the ability to bust through, it is 99% luck. Because I'm not more talented than 99% of the population, but I've managed to get a 30-year career out of it, right? The same with Keanu Reeves. Is he the most talented actor from his generation? What happened to all the other guys from that same era? The Emilio Estevez's and Charlie Sheen's and Kiefer Sutherland's and all that kind of stuff. It's just like, wow, boom, Bertolucci wants to work with him. Scorsese, beep, 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 beep. And then suddenly he's got...
I mean, look, he got The Matrix after Will Smith said no and Brad Pitt said no.
That, absolutely. But then he did it again on John Wick. That's fucking
amazing. But he is, I mean, let's just, he's the second coming of Christ. I mean, we all know that Keanu Reeves is the second coming of Christ. Let's all just agree that that's the way it is. He walks on water. it's a weird thing. I mean, trying to pinpoint success in this business, and trust me, I've made a career of analyzing early in my career. I read every biography. I absorbed every DVD commentary and Laserdisc commentary. I'm that old. All of it, trying to figure out what the secret sauce was. Like, how did this get in? How did that get in? Well, I have to just, okay, so I have to make a short film, but then have the script ready for it. And then, okay, so then I have to have the short film that blows up. Then I have to have the script ready for it. Then I also have to have some sort of financing. Maybe I have to have a package ready together for it. So I went through all of those because I had a short film in 2005 that blew up online in 2005 before YouTube or any of that stuff. And I was being called by big producers and I was being, you know, courted around town and all that stuff. And they're like, well, what do you have? I'm like, I have ideas. And they're like, well, that's not enough. So then the next time I did it a few years later, I'm like, I have the script now. That wasn't enough. Okay, now I need to get a package. Okay, great. I have to break it down. I got to get a budget, a schedule. I got to get a pitch deck now. It's just nonstop. So, but then somebody will walk in with a script or an idea and someone's like, oh, I like that idea. How much do you want for it? I've heard that story. How much do you want for it? Oh, do you need $1 million? I have $1 million. Let's go make a movie. It's resilience, man. It's just being in the game. And I think at a certain point, you just got to continue to be in the game. I always talk to people from the 90s, like they're like a foreign thing. We are kind of, our generation is. But talking to let's say a Kevin Smith, a Robert Rodriguez, an Ed Burns, those guys that came up in the 90s, I asked Ed Burns specifically, I go, Ed, would Brothers McMullen even make a dent today? He's like, no. There's no way in hell Brothers McMullen would even be anywhere in the conversation. Clerks wouldn't be in the
theaters.
Much less make $20 million in the theater like his did. like off of a $30,000 movie. Mariachi probably wouldn't make any noise today. Clerks wouldn't make any noise today. Like there's none of those movies would make noise today.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but movies still make noise. It's just not those movies. Cause I've just mentioned like Whiplash or Blue Ruin or these ones, the smaller ones that I'm talking about. They do pop through, and whether it's those $5 million Blumhouse kind of movies, there's some brilliant filmmaking going on. So it's not Clerks, but it's a different genre. It's a different movie.
But the backyard personal film, you know, like Slacker, that for that to do what it did, like Slacker, not in a million effing years would that get attention today. It just wouldn't. It'd be an art house film. But it wouldn't do what it did. Like it wouldn't go into theaters. But also don't forget, different timing, different place. There was an industry coming around, a business coming around independent film, which there wasn't in the 80s, really. In the 90s, and then VHS showed up and all that kind of stuff. So it's like someone like Jordan Peele with Get Out. And you mentioned Whiplash. Both of those are Jason Blum.
Yeah.
They're both Jason Blum. And how did, Jordan Peele, nobody wanted to make Get Out. And you're like, who are you? The guy from Comedy Central? And you're doing comedy, now you want to do horror? Like, what is this?
Exactly. So I don't think it's fair to be so negative on, Linklater wouldn't have a career now. And
it would be different.
It would be different. Those guys are going to, they're survivors anyway. And Jordan Peele wouldn't have got his movie made in 1992.
No, there's no way in hell. But the difference is Get Out might have been made as a backyard indie and maybe would have gotten some notice. Mm-hmm. But the difference between both of those films is they had an 800-pound gorilla attached, which was Jason Blum.
Yeah, true.
And that pushed that opened the doors and gave them a little bit of a budget. It's like Jason's given a lot of opportunities to filmmakers that wouldn't get opportunities. In today's world, Jason Blum's an anomaly.
Yeah, okay, but what did you see this movie called Under the Silver Lake?
Oh, God.
It takes place in Silver Lake here in L.A. It's another one of these little movies like the one that the Synchronic guys did.
Okay. I haven't seen it.
I don't know who the 800-pound gorilla is behind these things, but they're fucking amazing little tiny movies. But I wanted to talk about blown opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just because, you know, to switch it up, I worked in the late 80s, I believe it was the late 80s, with Chris Tucker, right? Chris Tucker was on a roll from his movie with Charlie Sheen, Easy Money or whatever the fuck it was.
Money Talks, yeah.
Yeah, and then he was on Rush Hour and he was in Jackie Brown and whatever. And I was working with a guy named Antoine Fisher, the screenwriter.
I know, yeah.
He was a friend of Tucker's, and he had come up with this idea about Chris Tucker being the first 00 agent. It was called 00 Soul. And he had set up the pitch. And it was with the producer I knew at Universal. And they were like, okay, this guy's done a couple of movies. And they partnered me up with Antoine. So Chris Tucker is on the verge of Eddie Murphy, Will Smith style.
Absolutely. Fame. Absolutely.
And we're working on this project. And he continuously is undermining himself and fucking himself up. Like he wanted Mariah Carey to be in a role in the movie. And there was this Divas concert in New York, and he was supposed to fly from L.A. to the Divas concert, meet her backstage, and pitch her on co-starring in this movie with them. Instead, they get a call at the production company, and it's his brother or assistant or whatever, and they go, yeah, I'm looking out our window, and I see a town car. Yeah? Yeah, it's to take him to the airport. He goes, no, Chris Tucker doesn't ride in no half a car. He needs a stretch.
Oh, God.
So get him a stretch or he's not going to the airport. They don't get him to the airport on time. That wasn't the only thing he did. We were rewriting the script continuously based on his whims where he would go, I ran into Tiger Woods at a party. Can we do a scene with me and Tiger at a golf course? And you're like,
how do you jam that in? Yeah, how do you jam that in?
Yeah, sure. Right. And then we turn in the draft. Everyone's excited about it. And he goes, I've changed my mind. I want the whole movie to take place in Africa. Because he'd gone to visit Africa and had been inspired by something. And we're like, just shut your fucking mouth and you would have had, you know, a spy movie. God only knows if it would have been a success. But it never got made. And his career didn't go the Will Smith way. Because he got so fucking in his own head, he ruined it.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Which was a bummer for everybody involved. Antoine and, you know.
Yeah, it was so funny because I always, you know, I was a fan of him in the Rush Hour films and in Money Talks. And he was right on the brink of being Eddie Murphy, the new Eddie Murphy. There was no question.
Yeah.
But I always wondered, like, what happened behind the scenes that it just fell off a cliff. He just fell off a cliff. He was in nothing. Like, he didn't just do bit parts. He, like, did nothing at all.
That I don't know, but I know that Universal did not want to work with him after he fucked everybody around for so long.
Of course. Yeah. And that gets around town.
Yes. The other one is my cautionary tale, which was I wrote a movie called Triple X. This Vin Diesel.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
What do you call it? X Games sort of James Bond.
Sure.
And then after that, every job I got, they were like, we want you to triple X this motherfucker. We want this to be just the same. But so I wrote Castle Wolfenstein and I wrote another one for Vin called The Wheelman about a getaway driver. But I was actively resisting doing triple X. I was like, I did triple X to get into the blockbuster business.
In the party. Now, you're invited into the party now.
Yeah. So the first thing I did after Triple X, before it even came out, I got The Dirt, adapting the Motley Crue biopic. And I was like, that's what I really want to do. I wanted to do what the Weitz brothers did. Remember, they did American Pie, and then immediately they jumped to, you know.
About a boy, right?
And Golden Compass and all of these.
Yeah. You know,
that's what I wanted. But everybody wanted. So I would say, okay, I'm going to write Castle Wolfenstein or whatever it is, but it's not going to be filled with X Games craziness. I don't want to do that. I want to do it this way. And they go, yeah, 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 of course. That's exactly what we want. And then I turn it in and they go, we don't want this. We want the shit that you said you weren't going to do. And I was so resistant to being pigeonholed that I refused to write one of those kind of movies. Right. And as a consequence, it took from between XXX and When the Dirt Finally Got Made, it was a span of 17 years.
Right.
Where I didn't get a feature film made.
Right.
Because I was like, I need to write the classy. And I wrote a shit ton of classy book adaptations based on bestsellers and whatever. I had one with the Russo brothers with Johnny Depp that didn't get made. You know, I mean, it's just an endless litany of classy movies that didn't get made when I could have been.
You could have been busting out. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway,
that was my
own bit of shooting myself in the foot, the way Chris Moore was talking about the other day when he had the $5 million for the startup and refused to do podcasts So,
that's a really interesting story because, we all wish we have the option one day to get it our own way. Cause that, like, you, most people will never get to the place you got with XXX. Bottom line, it was a huge hit, big action franchise, and, you know, one of the biggest stars at the time in the world and all of this stuff. Most people listening won't ever get there. But there's a lesson here, even for those who don't get to that level, it's getting in your own way, stopping things like, oh, I don't want to do that, or I want to. So I'll tell you my story really quickly. And this is my early on story. Not nearly as exciting as yours, but I think there's a lesson here. So I was 20 something. And it was right before I wanted to turn into a commercial director. So I was editing. I was editing a lot. I was like one of the big editors in Miami at the time in the late 90s. I was up getting paid obscene amounts of money to edit. And I got so far up my own ass that I was like, I'm going to throw down 50 G's on my demo reel to direct, you know, get my, and I had to shoot it on 35 and, you know, the whole thing.
Sure. Yeah.
So when I did all of that, put it out, I spent my, and then I stopped editing. I just said, I'm not an editor anymore. I am a director. I am a director. I do not sully myself with editing anymore. I will not dirty my, I will not go down to that level. That's the mentality that I had at the time because I was so full of myself. And then I would get calls and I'd be like, nope, don't edit anymore. I'm a director only. So I start shipping out my demo reels and I'm spending money like it doesn't end. Because I'm like, anytime now, all I need is that one gig.
It's going to kick in, yeah.
One gig, I'll get paid 5 G's a day. You know, I'll get 30, 40 grand in about a month or two, anytime now. That day never showed up. And then I got thrown into a dark, dark hole that it was harder and harder. And then weirder things happened. I wrote a whole book about my next adventures. But that was the beginning of this hole that I fell into that took me years to come back out of. And sure. I was able to crawl back out of it by just hustle and getting out of my own way. But so many of us as creatives, we will start overthinking, getting in our own heads. And man, I can only imagine. How old were you when you did XXX?
30, 31.
Yeah, so at 30, 31, I was still, it wasn't a complete moron, but I was slightly moronic. my own personal journey. There's 20 year olds who are much smarter than I was at 30.
Sure.
But at that age, still, you still haven't lived. You've got a lot yet, and you haven't been you haven't been beat up enough yet.
But dude, all of the people that we talk about that we admire, from Tarantino to Kevin Smith, they all made that jump and said, fuck it. I'm doing it my way. I'm not going to cast so-and-so. I want it to be Michael Madsen, or whoever the fuck, all of those people did it and made the jump.
But
they stuck the landing where we did not. So does that make them stupid? I mean, does that make us stupid for making that leap just like they did? Because we didn't have the luck to stick the landing.
But the thing is, but that's the thing though. So let's analyze Kevin for a second, because I've studied Kevin. You know, Kevin came up with my movie because I worked in a video store. I was very upset about The Clerks because I worked in a video store when that came out. I'm like, son of a God, why did I think of that? And I mean, you know how many video clerks around the country were like, oh God. But after Clerks, he did Mallrats. his way. He wanted to do it his way. Studio gave him money and it tanked and it was over for Kevin. It was over. The only way he came back out was because of Chasing Amy. And there was the Weinsteins who gave him $150,000 to make as a throwaway. Like, look, kid, here's $100,000. Go make your movie, but that's all you're getting. And he got a he happened to have a young Ben Affleck, which I know you worked with a young Ben Affleck as well, that happened to hit. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. If Chasing Amy doesn't hit, we don't know who Kevin Smith. He's just a blip in history.
Exactly. He is you and I. However, he did that stupid thing, but he stuck the landing and was successful at it. And that's why we admire guys like that. And we tried to emulate them, and it didn't work out in quite the same way.
And that's a mistake that a lot of filmmakers and screenwriters make to this day. They'll look at someone like Tarantino, like, well, Tarantino, them like, and I always like to say, Tarantino is probably the most original writer of his generation. The skills and the way he tells stories is unprecedented. You like him or hate him, I don't care. There's no one who writes like him. He is the Hemingway of his generation. Again, whether you love him or hate him, you can't deny what the man has done.
Yeah.
You can't compare yourself to him. It's like me comparing myself to Spielberg or to Fincher or to Nolan. Like, these are people who are at the highest level. And look at Nolan.
That's like, a good point. That's a good point. Yeah.
Because you can't compete. You can't, like, you know, can you compare yourself to Robert Rodriguez? How many people, to this day, people are still talking about mariachi. To this day, people still use it as a reference point. And I'm like, you can't, like, Robert, he stumbled into it. No one was ever supposed to see mariachi. Yeah. It was supposed to go straight to the Spanish video market. And it just happened that someone said, we're going to release it. And he said, no, don't release this. This was like my practice movie. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Let me remake it. Don't let me. So he did remake it in Desperado, essentially, but a little bit better, like a little bit bigger. But that's what he felt. He literally stumbled into it. You know, so you can't do that. Brothers McMullen, if he wasn't working at E.T. at Entertainment Tonight and Bob Redford didn't jump on an elevator and he didn't have a VHS copy of Brothers McMullen Rough Cut.
That's what happened.
And he handed it to Bob. And like 2 months later, someone from Sundance called him and was like, is your movie ready? We'd like to screen it. That doesn't happen. You see what I'm saying? Like, there was no way a PA from Entertainment Tonight was going to get into Sundance for an unknown like Edward Burns. But that's exactly what happened. So you can't plan for that stuff. You can't. Like, I had the pleasure of meeting Roger Ebert before he passed at a screening.
That's time to meet him.
I mean, but I had the pleasure of being flown up to Toronto because I was going, like, there were some producers and financiers who wanted to finance my short film, my feature film version of my short film in 2005. So I fly up there. And he's like, here's some tickets to a movie that we're distributing. Go see this movie. So we went to the theater. We're sitting down. And in the back of the freaking theater is Roger Ebert. And people who don't know who Roger Ebert is, please Google him. He's one of the greatest film critics of all time. He's the only one who's ever won a Pulitzer. That's how great he was. And we happen to run up to him and start talking to him. And like, oh, my God, this and that. And this is our movie. Like, and this is before the movie starts. And we'd like to start talking to him. And he's like, you know, I can't watch your movie. I'm like, of course not. You can't watch our movie. You're Roger Ebert. Why would you watch our little $8,000 action movie? And then all of a sudden, halfway through the conversation, he's like, can I take your picture? I'm like, yes. And he's like, you know what? This will make a nice little piece for my blog. I'm like, great. Can we take your picture? And here's a copy of our movie. By the time we landed back in Florida, he had already watched a movie and written a small review of the film on his website. And all of a sudden, I'm the only short film on the planet that has a Roger Ebert quote. Wow. But you see what I'm saying? How could you plan for that?
What would you do differently? I mean, if I guess in retrospect, if I had serviced if I'd milked the XXX vibe for as much as it was worth,
sure.
Would I have been happier spending my time writing movies that I wasn't excited about, rather than the time I've been spending on adapting books that don't get made. I get a lot of satisfaction from all of these scripts that are sitting on my shelf that no one's ever going to read or see. It's weird, you know. Would I be happier the other way?
So that's the question. So, I mean, this has turned into a therapy session, which I absolutely love, and I think it's something that we all need to hear. Therapy session for both of you and I. So I think, and everyone listening can kind of get into it. But what this is my feeling. Like, again, I didn't have your experience. You had a huge hit. You were the belle of the ball. People wanted to work with you because you had a monster hit in town. So the question is, could you have – the way I would have looked at it is this. At 30, I would have put my big boy pants on. I would have written a handful of things that they wanted me to do, and then step up a little bit more and step up a little bit more.
Yeah.
And maybe get a couple, maybe get another XXX like style success. And then at that point, start like once you establish yourself a little bit more, continue to write those for a few years, not gonna hurt you. At that point, on the side, you're working on other stuff and trying to get other things made. But you're building up your reputation in town. And okay. I've seen that from so many screenwriters who told me, I didn't want to do it, but I did it because it was a paycheck. It kept me in the conversation.
Yes.
And that's the difference.
But here's what happened. After I realized that I needed to make an adjustment, which it took me like, I don't know, let's say 5 years.
Sure.
I started taking these assignments that were very straightforward, you know, a remake of Cliffhanger, you know, various action movies and whatever. Lightning didn't strike twice. They did not get made.
Right.
It's fucking difficult to build one on top of another. Like the guy who wrote XXX 2 starred Ice Cube.
Right.
Different director, different writer. And that guy was Simon Kinberg.
Yeah, I just had Simon on the show.
Okay. Yeah. So his version of XXX grossed $25 million. And mine had grossed 175 or two, whatever it was.
Yeah.
A quarter of a billion. I guess it was 250. I don't know, whatever the fuck it was. He went on to have a string of these action movies that were consistently getting made and moneymakers and whatever. And obviously more talented than me. But it has been consistently building to the point that he's a producer on superhero movies in addition to writing, in addition to directing and whatever. So lightning struck with him, even though his XXX was a failure.
But the difference with Simon is that he was lucky enough to land in the X-Men universe at Fox. And the second he landed in the X-Men universe at Fox, one hit led to another hit, and then he stayed in the. And did you see what he did? He stayed in the X-Men up to Deadpool, up to Logan as a producer. He understood. He's like, I'm gonna stick to this. And he just finished releasing 355 with Jessica Chastain, all the girls, which is unlike anything else he's been doing lately. But it's taken him years to do that. Now there's some, and there's nothing wrong with that because I still think some of the stuff he's done, like he'll get Deadpool made, which is one of the best superhero. He got Logan made. He wrote Days of Future Past, which is probably arguably one of the better superhero genre time travel movies ever made. You know, he's definitely a talented dude, but he got on a train at the right time. When things were like, oh, and the way you know how studios work, oh, you know X-Men. Well, let's keep him on. Okay, you wrote one X-Men movie. You could write another X-Men movie. So it's the same thing for you. I wrote one XXX movie. I want to add your spice to this. He kept riding that train. You decided to go against the train. And 5 years.
Yes. So what I wound up doing is I wrote for Legendary. Years ago, I wrote an adaptation of Kung Fu. They already had a director attached they were excited about.
Sure.
Because of that, I got recommended to write Iron Fist for Marvel.
Okay. The movie or the show?
It was a movie.
Okay, the movie at the time. Okay.
This was they were doing the first phase, and they were trying to figure out who's going to be in the second phase. So they developed 8 characters and picked 4 and made movies out of them. So my Iron Fist movie was not chosen.
One of those, right.
But if it was, I could have been in the Marvel universe. So even when it came time and getting the chance to write a Marvel movie early on, you know, when they were still in phase one, it did not work out for whatever reason. And I've had so many things, and everybody does, have movies fall apart. We have the financing, we have a director, we have everything lined up, and then it blows up with, through none of your own, you know. So it, sure. In addition to luck being a factor, bad luck is a huge factor in shit just blowing up. And the quality of the movies that I've had that slipped through my fingers with the Russo brothers, with Fincher, with a thing with Dr. Dre, all of these great, a thing with Vince McMahon, all of these things that fucking blew up on me. I'm fine with it because it's happened so many times. But all right, here's one. Nobody knows about this one, but when they were shooting From Dusk Till Dawn,
sure,
I was writing Green Hornet for some for Larry Gordon.
Okay.
Robert Rodriguez gets a hold of the script, gives it to Clooney. They're going to do it together. I meet with Clooney. And he's so excited. We're going to start shooting. We got the money. We're going to start shooting in March.
Right.
Then he gets a phone call from Steven Spielberg saying, I just started SKG DreamWorks. I want you to star in our first movie.
Peacemaker. Mm-hmm. With Nicole. Yeah. With
Mimi Leader. So he had to drop out of ours because you don't say no to Spielberg. He did that one. Once he dropped out, Robert Rodriguez dropped out. They brought in Michel Gondry. Mm-hmm. He was involved with it 10 years before he actually made it at another studio. And it went nowhere with Michel Gondry. But we were, I don't know, it was December when they pulled the plug and we were going to be shooting at the beginning of March. And that would have been fucking huge, you know.
Of course.
Clooney at that time, Robert Rodriguez at that time, it would have been spectacular. Really, so I've got a litany of those that have exploded in my face.
So all right, so then I'll tell you my story, and then
yeah,
because this is a therapy section.
Drinking stories. These are great get together.
Yeah, these are great. So I'll tell you my story. I wrote a book. Where is it? Here it is. And everyone listening who listens to the show knows about this. The book is called Shooting for the Mob.
Oh, nice.
Okay. Right. So this book is based on my experience of almost making a $20 million movie for the mafia. Now, I was 26. See, no, we'll throw it down. Don't get me wrong. You got much better, higher quality stars in your story, but mine.
Yeah, but I wasn't about to get whacked.
There's that. So I had a bipolar, basically sociopathic gangster who gave me the shot, quote unquote, to direct his life story. And I was then, our production offices were in a racetrack from the 1960s. So literally I was like in a lounge, and they built an office partition for me in the lounge. We hired production designers. We hired a DP, flew him in from LA. We were in prep for a year.
Holy shit.
So while this is going on, he's hustling money to keep the office open because he can't get the 20 million. But the crazy part, and that's a fantastic story, just a mobster trying to get his movie made with a young director. And I kept asking him, like, and I'd been directing already a little bit. I've been directing commercials and all this kind of stuff. And I said, why aren't you going after some like somebody who's more seasoned than me? And he's like, oh, no, I don't like those Hollywood guys. I want someone honest like you. I'm like, all right, great. So I'm there. But don't forget, I was raised in the 90s under the 90s indie boom for
the rules,
which were like the lottery ticket. Everyone had a lottery ticket. The Kevin Smiths, the Edward Burns, the Roger, you know, Slacker, everyone. So I'm like, this has got to be my lottery ticket, right? So then Hollywood takes this guy seriously, and I'm flown out to LA, and I meet billion-dollar producers. I'm in the penthouses of a huge producer, like it's the end scene from A True Romance. I'm in his screening room showing him the trailer that I had shot that spent $10,000 that I didn't have to shoot a sizzle reel of the movie that we shot it on film, flew in actors. It was a whole thing. So we did that whole thing. So I'm there with him. I'm at the Chateau Marmont. I'm at the fucking Ivy. I'm everywhere. And I'm like, this has to be real. Yeah. While this is all going on, he's threatening me all the time. I'm basically going to work with Joe Pesci from Goodfellas. Like, one moment, he's the best, funniest dude ever. And the next moment, he's like, I will hit you over the head with a shovel and bury you somewhere. And imagine a 26-year-old who I'm green as all hell, truly. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I'm like, I didn't have any defense against a guy like this. When I saw the adults, the seasoned professionals around me were all scared to death. And these guys were all in movies for 20 years. And I'm like, what the hell am I going to do? Then I'm like flown out and I'm meeting, I went to go meet Batman. So I go to Batman's house, Wayne Manor, like one of the actors who played Batman.
Did these remain nameless?
They're all remain nameless. I'll tell you after we get off. Because in the book, my rules are, if I met you, your name is changed. If I talked about you, we had meetings with producers for Mel Gibson, Robert Downey Jr., William Hurt, Gabriel Byrne, like all the hot people from, this is all 2001. It's all like early 2001. This is all started. So I go to Batman's house. I'm there like this close to Batman. And Batman's like, I want to be in your movie. You know, do you want to sleep over tonight so we can work on the project? Like, and he's on a 25,000 acre ranch, you know, 3 days after Christmas. And then all of a sudden, after all of that, it's gone. It just goes away. And the gangster's like, you know what? Yeah, we're going to go another direction after a year of this. And the movie never got as close ever again to getting made than it was with me. But imagine, and I know you have this, you've experienced this at different levels, being so close to your dream and it getting yanked away from you constantly. I know you feel me because it's happened to you, but you've had success and you've had a career doing what you love to do. It might not be in the way that you might've envisioned it, but you've had a career. Like you said at the beginning of this entire conversation, I've made a living doing this, and that's great. But the frustration of, oh, the money's about to drop. This package is almost there. Oh, we're almost greenlit. I can only imagine. That happened to me once at a large level, then multiple other times at smaller levels, like, you know, being flown around and meeting producers and having sit downs with actors and, you know, this and that. I've gone through all of that. That's why I have shrapnel. We all both have had shrapnel from the war that we've been in, which is the business. But I could only imagine you going through this as well, because you're having that happen again and again and again. And you were in a position where this really could happen. Like, you weren't a young kid sitting down with George Clooney. You were already a seasoned screenwriter. It just, everything kept falling apart.
The thing that's interesting is that it happens at every level. Anybody who's trying to get a student film made, to try to shoot their own short film in high school, the actor falls out, the location falls out. Everything always is a problem. And so my thing when talking to somebody who wants to be in the industry is it is going to be a lot harder than you ever imagined it would be. If I had known all of the things, I don't know if I would have dared to enter this industry.
Right.
Knowing in advance how many setbacks there were going to be. But I like to be realistic with people. You're not going to, you know, star in one movie and have a career for the rest of your life. Write one hit and have a, you know, dinner with Spielberg the next week. It is always a constant struggle. And when you consider it took Spielberg 15 years to get his Lincoln movie made, it doesn't change no matter what level you're at.
Amen.
And I know for a fact that George Clooney has movies that he wishes he could get made that he cannot.
Correct.
And the same with any director you can think of. The same with I don't want to name the names, but it's the same across the board. No one is where they want to be, with the exception of maybe
Nolan, Tarantino, and James Cameron.
Wes Anderson, the Coen brothers. You know, it's maybe this many.
Yeah.
And we're just talking in feature films. So it is an endless life or death struggle every single time, no matter what level you're at. And you have to be ready for that. It doesn't turn into easy street ever. And this is the thing that impresses me most about Tarantino is every time he sits down to write a movie, he has to write a movie better than a Quentin Tarantino movie. Because if it's below the level of a Tarantino movie, it's a failure.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
He's competing with Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill. He's competing
Inglourious Bastards, the Django Unchained.
Ever. Right? I mean, it's insane. And everybody's doing that. Spielberg's competing against his entire, filmography. So it never, ever becomes easy. And Chris Moore, who you just had on, Oscar-nominated movie right out of the bat, never became easy after that for him. He's still slugging away. Ben and Matt have had their this and that. It's never, ever, ever going to get easier. So you better enjoy what you're doing and working with the people you're working with, because at the end of the day, that's what it is.
You know,
30 years into it and looking back and going, well, shit, either I'm pissed off this whole time or I've loved every minute of, nowadays, like when my Vince McMahon thing blew up a year ago, I so appreciate the time I got to spend in the world of WWE. And talk to his daughter and talk to him and talk to his right hand man and have all of that, no matter if it mounted up to anything. I really appreciate all of those things. And it's the same whether you're doing a short film, you're doing your $100,000, feature, you're going around begging for money and people are trusting you and believing in you. And that's the thing that you gotta appreciate.
I mean, I'll tell you, Rick Linkletter said it best. He gave me the best piece of advice. He's like, I asked him the question, like, what advice do you give for filmmakers? He goes, it's going to be twice as hard and twice as long as you thought. That's how long it's going to take. It's going to be twice as hard as you think, and it's going to be twice as long. I'd probably say it's 10 times harder, but
yeah.
That's
yeah. Maybe for him it's twice, but I mean, he's not getting to do everything he wants to do.
I can tell you for a fact that Rick is not doing everything he wants to do, because he told me directly. He's like, I want to do this, and this, and I'm like, but you're Richard Linklater. You're like an Oscar, Boyhood. Seriously, who the hell makes Boyhood? Like, other than Richard Linklater, like, who's insane enough?
Yeah.
To shoot a movie like Boyhood, like, oh yeah, we're going to shoot something and maybe we'll have something in 7 years. Like, that's insanity. But that's Rick. But Rick doesn't care about, he's an artist, man. He's one, when I met him and I've spent some time with him, he is a artist and he doesn't care about markets and this or that. He just has the pleasure. He's lucky enough to be able to do what he does because he keeps his budgets low. And that's why, the Coen brothers get to do what they do, because they keep their budgets low. Woody Allen back, when he was making movies, he kept his budgets low so he could do whatever the hell he wanted to.
And stars want to work with guys like that because they're artists too, and they'll do it for a discount rate. And that's why Wes Anderson gets all of these brilliant people,
PTA, all of them, yeah.
So the long and short is take the pleasures where you can get them. If at any point you get to make a movie, write a screenplay, act in something, that's something that most of the planet doesn't get to do and most of the planet wants to do. So if you even get close, if you get to edit your own movie that you shot on your phone, you are so far ahead of the game.
You're absolutely right. And I call what we do the beautiful sickness. Because it is the beautiful sickness, because once you have it, the sickness, you can't get rid of it. Like, you really can't. It can go dormant for decades, honestly. I've had people come in who are doctors and talk to me like, I just retired.
Yeah.
What I really want to do is direct. Yeah. And it's a true sickness that doesn't go away, but it's a beautiful sickness. And I think that's a weird thing about our business, is that this is not, and I've talked to so many different people about this. We're the weirdest business on the planet. We're the only business on the planet that could spend $200 million and literally have a worthless piece of product.
Yeah.
Literally could have, it could literally be, and it's happened. before, that you've spent $100 million and it just dies and it's like it's worthless. Where at least when you spend $200 million in construction, you got a $200 million building or cookies. You could buy $200 million worth of cookies. At least you have some cookies you can sell. There's a product. We sell air. We sell intangible dreams. It's such a weird business, and that's why it's so intoxicating.
Yeah, there are two things about it. One, we'd be doing it anyway, whether or not we had success.
Correct. I mean,
that's just, whether you got that book published or not, I'm sure that you would keep writing them. And two, the thing that keeps you going is you're always one thing away from massive success.
Oh, right? always.
One idea, one script, one performance in a
one
short
one person film. One person you meet. Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So which makes it beautiful, and especially when somebody like comes out of the blue and writes Gran Torino, or somebody gets success at a later age, or somebody makes a transition like Jordan Peele did from one genre to another, or the way Tom Hanks did. That's what's intoxicating about it and keeps you going.
But the thing is that people listening have to understand is that's the sickness part of the sickness. That's the sickness part, because it's almost like a gambler. The next bet is the one that's going to pop. The next bet. And there's how many professional gamblers out there who make a living as gamblers? Uh-huh. A very small amount, but everybody but Vegas runs on people who are not professional gamblers.
It's funny because we started with, God, we fucked up. We've got to temper our dreams and be realistic. And we're ending with, it's the fucking greatest lottery you could possibly imagine. One step away from working with Scorsese.
But the thing is that the key is that if you bet on black, more likely it's not going to hit. So you have to find your own path that makes you happy. And that's the key. And that was the one thing that I kind of finally came to grips with later in life, which is like, I need to find what makes me happy. And it doesn't have to be working on a Marvel movie. And as I say it in every episode, anytime I bring up Marvel, I go, Kevin Feige, if you're listening, I'll take the meeting. but it's not about that anymore for me. It's more about how, am I enjoying what I'm doing?
Yeah.
Am I providing value in one way, shape, or form to my community in one way, shape, or form? Can I go off and make my own movies that are personal? And I don't give a crap if they make money or not, because I make them for very little money.
You know, it just made me realize that I've made this adjustment in my own life of trying things where I have no intention of making a penny from it.
Yep.
And having it be so satisfying. I wanted to be a singer in a punk rock band. So I did that and went on the Warped Tour. I always wanted to try stand-up comedy. So right before the pandemic at in my 50s, I went on stage for the first time at open mics, and I've been doing it now for a couple of years. I'm terrible. I get no laughs, but
it's terrifying.
I hate it. I'm so nerve-wracked by doing it, but I'm forcing myself to do it because one day I hope to get comfortable doing it. And then I can at least look back and go, yeah, all right, I did it. I did it until I got comfortable. I'm not that funny, but it was fucking, it's a bucket list thing that I don't want to go back when I'm 90, if I make it that far, and wish that I'd given it some effort. So and same with, I went to cooking school because I wanted to do that, and I was shitty at that too, but it was personally rewarding. So if you can do that with music or poetry or like, what's the name? Seth Rogen now is doing pottery. You see him on Twitter doing all of his vases that he fires.
Oh, and Jim Carrey with the paintings. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all of that shit, I think there's even more satisfaction when you have no plan on trying to make a living at it.
You know, and I have to tell you that you're absolutely right. I mean, I started this podcast 6.5 years ago.
Wow.
And I've been doing this for 6.5 years. I was into podcasting when podcasting wasn't the cool thing to be. And now everybody's like, oh, I've got a podcast. So I came in just because I wanted to give back to my community. I wanted to build an online business. I wanted to see what I can make a go of this.
Sure.
There's no way I would have told you, if someone would have told me you're going to be able to make a living doing this. You're going to be able to shut down your post-production company. You're going to be able to retire from doing post-production and you're going to do this full time in a few years.
Wait, so what we're doing now, you're making a living at this?
110%. This is all
Holy
I do.
Shit.
This is all I do. This is not my side hustle. This is all I do. This is all I do. But it started as a side hustle, and I started it with an intention to make money with it at a certain point, but not to this level. I didn't think it was going to get to where it is. I didn't think I was going to be talking to people like yourself or other than many guests that I've talked to. I would have never, if you would have told me that I would have had access to the kind of people I talk to, I would have said, you're absolutely insane. You're absolutely insane. But
what you're providing is a resource for all of the kids that want to be making films or doing whatever, writing television, writing books, that didn't exist in the 1990s. You'd have to buy Linklater's book or see, you know, go to a Q&A at a film festival to find out what somebody did. And now on a weekly basis, I don't know how often you put these things out, but the
2 to 3 times a week.
Wow. That's a lot of talking. But like you said, the Chris Moore one that you just put out is filled with so much useful information from the past to the present, that's just invaluable. And I think you're giving everybody such a leg up, and then I'm hoping that it, you know, kicks, that we get some kick-ass movies to watch out of it, you know?
I've had a few listeners who've been able to go off and make their movies, and I've had a pleasure of having them on the show, and they've told me, like, if it wasn't for you and wasn't for the show, I wouldn't have done this or this. Yeah. I had one guy who wrote you'll like this story. He wrote a $1 million movie. He financed it himself because he's a commercial director, big commercial director in Australia. He's like, I'm gonna go make a movie. He made a movie in Cambodia about robots who come in and start, like, you know, like soldier robots who come down. They drop them into the jungle as a test, and they start killing tourists, American tourists. All right, great, right? And you think, that sounds like an asylum movie. That doesn't sound like it's going to look good at all. He sent me the trailer for it. It looks like a $50 million movie. It looks so good. He's like, Alex, after reading your second book, this one, about being an entrepreneurial filmmaker, he goes, I'm not going to go with the studios. So I got a $1 million offer, but I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to self-distribute it.
Oh, nice.
As an experiment. And he goes, I'm going to do it because of you. And I talked to him a bunch, and I guided him through it. I'm like, all right, man, this is going to be a hell of a test to my theories. And he made his budget back in 3 months.
Jesus.
3 months. And he's gotten called from every studio on the planet, including the big, including, you know, the Mouse and everybody else, wanting him to, because the quality of what he did was unheard of. And that was something that the show helped. Not that his talent, but helped him get to where he's at with this situation.
Yes. I feel like we've taken a turn into the too positive, and I'm more cynical and sarcastic by nature. So I wanna get away from
Don't worry. No, it's all to hell. It's all to hell. It's all to hell. No, this whole business, you're gonna, why even be here? I mean, seriously, why even start down this path? You're gonna fail. No, I'm joking. Look, we are allowed to be cynical because we're both old farts, and that's fine because we've been around the block a couple times. But I hope what this episode has shown people is, you know, the truth of what it's like being a creative in the business, and from two different perspectives. My perspective from someone who's really been, I've really been looking outside into the party. I've snuck into the party a few times. I've even been invited into the party a few times, but security shortly thereafter finds me and kicks me out. Yeah. And that's fine. And now I get invited to more parties, but it's all fine and dandy. You were in the party, and then you had issues inside the party, and you've been able to maintain yourself inside the party, even though there is a room with a rope, and that's where you really want to get to.
I feel like I'm in the NFL, but I'm on the bench. I'm the
right. You see everything else,
but I'm on the team.
You get the ring, baby. You get the ring. You get the ring. If
I get to dress with the big boys, yeah.
You know, but it's a really fascinating. Like, this conversation, I did not plan it to go this direction, so I'm so happy it did, because this has been one of the more interesting, you know, conversations.
I'm going to be honest with you. This is the second best of your podcasts that I've listened to. This is my second one listening to it, and this is definitely
listening to yourself talk.
Yeah, Chris Moore is here, and then this one is down here. But I'm already getting sick of myself talking, so we better.
Yeah. Short. So I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests. I think we've already asked the one question. What advice would you give a filmmaker or screenwriter trying to break into the business today? I think that's been discussed.
Don't do it. Yeah. don't try.
Don't even. No. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
It was the thing we talked about, to take pleasure in the process. It's the journey, not the destination, which is the worst cliche ever. But that's what it is. You're not going to ever get where you want in life. So you better fucking enjoy whatever it is you have for the time you're here.
Amen. What I mean,
one of my best friends getting a brain tumor and dropping dead in his 40s, leaving behind two teenage daughters, that teaches you everything you need to know. It takes something like that. But you're like, okay, that's it. I'm set for the rest of my life. My mental state is... this is it. It could leave anytime. So fucking it. Enjoy it.
Absolutely. Tomorrow, as cliche it is, tomorrow is not promised. It is not guaranteed, but we all think it is. It's such a weird thing that we as humans do. We're like, oh yeah, I'll be here tomorrow.
Yeah. All right. But we're both getting into Tony Robbins territory.
Hey, listen. Stop
it. Next question.
I want to walk on the coals. And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Okay. Project Day Part 2, okay. Gallipoli, and Caddyshack.
Man, that's a hell of a screening.
I normally have a top five, and Goodfellas is one.
Yep.
And I forgot what the other one is, but it was great. It's a great movie. Recommend it. The cliche, it's always, Star
Godfather,
Wars.
Godfather.
And those are great and inspirational, but there's ones that just, are part of your life. And Caddyshack and Jackie Chan and these things have just sort of burrowed into my head and reflect a lot of it. Mostly it's music that drives mm-hmm. me. Everything that I write or work on is somehow involved with music.
Yeah, so, there's no question. I could see that in your filmography without question. And well, for me, it's Shawshank, Fight Club, Matrix.
It's not a bad list.
Those are the ones that just, and again, of course, Star Wars, and of course, Clockwork Orange and Shining and all of Kubrick and,
I wanted to be different. I remember Cuckoo's Nest, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, so
that's a huge one for me.
Can you imagine trying to get that movie made today? By studio?
Yeah.
Good luck. Taxi Driver. Get Sony to do Taxi Driver today. Let me see how that works out. My friend, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It has been it's been eye-opening, to say the least. And I hope it helps some filmmakers and screenwriters out there, man. So thank you, brother.
Yes. I was trying to hold up something that could hype, that I could try to get to pimp in my website. I don't know. Something. I got nothing to sell. So.
We'll put links to you in the show notes if you want to reach out, man. I appreciate you, brother.
All right. Thanks, man.
I want to thank Rich so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today, his raw knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Rich. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/169. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.